I will restart our committee hearing now that we have the recording started. This is Transportation Finance Committee, and it's March 1st, new month, new time. And today our order of business will be going right into testifying by the Met Council, giving us an update and moving forward. Is Jen going to start? Judd, are you starting?
Mr. Chair and members, I am going to start, but I'll have Mr. Furman with Metro Transit join us as well. I'm just looking for a little help from the audience here quick to pull up our presentation. I am, here we go. And Mr. Chair, what we're prepared to do today is to respond to the committee's request to provide an update on the Southwest LRT line, the Botno LRT line, and then also to speak to the contractor issue that has been raised related to the Southwest procurement. So we will be prepared to speak to that. I know that the committee is also asked to hear from the legislative auditor regarding some transit financial reviews that were done in quarter two and quarter three of last year, and I know Ms. Randall is likely to speak to that, and the council will be prepared to offer comments after she's done, and then I know that we'll be hearing from Mr. Lee. But in the meantime, I'd like to introduce Mark Furman. He's our Assistant General Manager at Metro Transit, and we'll be able to speak to the Southwest and Botno updates that the committee's asked for.
Well, welcome to the committee, and why don't you please identify for us yourself and continue on with the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Mark Furman, Deputy General Manager with Metro Transit, reporting to the Metropolitan Council. I thought it'd be best to start with the global picture, the regional picture, and that is our metro system map that you see here. And that represents what we have approved and adopted in our transportation policy plan, our vision really for 2040, as we would envision continuing to build out our metro system. Obviously, we have the blue line, green line, and red line segment in Dakota County in place, and then these other projects are all in various phases of development. I'm very pleased to report that in 2017, all three of our rail lines, the blue line, the green line, and the North Star commuter rail line, set ridership records. Mm-hmm. In total, we served 24.6 million passengers on those three rail lines. 10.7 million on the blue, the best blue line in its history, now over 14 years. 13.1 million on the green line, its best since opening in 2014. And 800,000 on the North Star line, again, its best since it opened in 2009. I know that the committee has some interest in kind of where things are at with the federal funding, and so I bring to you this map that shows a snapshot based on the earlier this month, now I guess last month, February, the annual report that the federal administration makes to the Congress on the New Starts program. And so this map shows you that current status delineated between different phases in these New Starts projects. Project development is kind of the first phase once these projects are approved into this capital improvement grant pipeline. Engineering is the next phase, and then the third and final phase is the construction grant agreement that I show here is the full funding grant agreement. So I highlight the fact that our region, Minneapolis-St. Paul, actually has three of these New Starts projects that are approved and active in the federal pipeline, and that is the Green Line extension, the Blue Line extension, and just a little over a month ago, the Gold Line BRT project to the east of downtown St. Paul out to Maplewood and Woodbury. I think it's also important to note that in the recent past, 2017, the Congress and the President signed into law the appropriations for this program. The authorizing bill called the FAST Act a few years ago called for $2.3 billion for this program in 2017, 18, 19 through fiscal 2020. when that authorization concludes. In 2017, the Congress appropriated $2.5 billion, even above the authorizing level, and that was with the budget caps in place. And that included it included $10 million for the Southwest LRT project. As you well know, 2018 is being hotly finalized here with a target to finish that up by the third week of March, by March 23rd. And so the appropriators are working very hard to conclude that. As you probably also are aware, earlier in February, the Congress did provide some relief for those budget caps. And so that will allow them a little bit more headroom to make those 2018 appropriations in the next 3 weeks. And then lastly, 2019 has been proposed by the administration here just a couple weeks ago. And what that indicates is to fund all the green stars on this map, those existing full funding grant agreements, but it also has not provided or not recommended any funding for those red and blue dot projects on the map. So we'll be continuing to work with the Congress, as historically, as I've been involved in this program now for over three decades. The Congress does the appropriations for these projects and to construct these projects. I'd also like to highlight on a regional level that as these projects begin in the federal New Starts process, we then track what the development is within a half-mile radius of those future stations, and we continue to track them as those services and those stations become in service. And what we have found is over $8 billion has been generated in terms of development within that shadow of all those stations. And you can see the scatter map here. It gives you an indication from downtown St. Paul to downtown Minneapolis, from the Mall of America Bloomington through Minneapolis, and now we're tracking the Blue Line extension all the way to Brooklyn Park, as well as tracking the Green Line extension developments, of which there's $1 billion worth of announced developments in and around those future Green Line extension stations. I should also just footnote one thing here. I've purposely excluded any of the costs of development of any of the new stadia that have been built along these lines. So there's no money from U.S. Bank Stadium, Target Field, XL, CHS Field, TCF Bank Stadium. None of those costs to build those stadia are included in any of these totals. So, Mr. Chair, I'll just take a quick pause there from a regional perspective before I move to the specific updates for the Green Line extension and subsequently Blue Line extension to respond to any questions that the committee may have.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your very first page, you started making me nervous, but because what happens with any mention of Riverview, Red Rock, Rush Line? Have they dropped off the map?
Over again.
Mr. Chair and Congresswoman, got the federal in my mindset. Representative Hausman, excuse me. Those projects are certainly active, but they continue in the pre-project development phase, as you well know. And so, as those projects gain more specificity in the coming year or two, then they would be incorporated into this metro system map.
Follow-up, Representative Hausman. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You didn't mention anything related to North Star. I know you were talking about Southwest, but since it is rail and transit related, are there any upcoming investments in North Star that you anticipate? I understand there's a tail track extension planned for that.
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, I spoke about the ridership record for North Star. I did not speak to that point that you asked about, which is an adjustment in the location of the tail track. and that is part of one of the elements of the Met Council BNSF draft agreement that we have been working on with them as it would relate to the Southwest LRT project.
A follow-up, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Furman, is there a, how is that being paid for, that potential possible tail track extension?
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that would be a Southwest LRT eligible cost and therefore paid for by solely Hennepin County cost and then the federal match.
Thank you.
Mr. Furman, I don't know what a tail track is.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry about that. Let me pause to explain that those trains for North Star come in from Big Lake and Sherburne and Anoka counties in the morning, and then they essentially park on that tail track during the midday so that then for the evening outbound trips, they can then be readily available to pull out and then return those commuters back to their home stations. And so this is a tail track that accommodates a few of those North Star trains during the midday.
Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Representative Rembeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Furman, so it appears you mentioned the ridership for the rail lines, but it appears still that if nothing else, ridership for total transit is dropping. And I just wanted to see if that is of a concern to the Met Council. Does that change your plans? And then I'm just going to note that in the presentation we heard at the commission in December, we heard that total ridership was 97 million, but the newspaper reported it a few weeks later as 81 million. So I'm really not sure what your ridership numbers are, but it does seem like, you know, we're spending a lot more money but not gaining ridership.
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, let's first speak to the total numbers that you cited. The 81 to 82 million rides in 2017 and 2016. Those are Metro Transit only rides, rail and bus. The additional 12 or 14 million rides are from other suburban transit authorities, University of Minnesota shuttle, Metro Mobility services that are additive to the Metro Transit total to get you to that mid 90 million regional total. To the first half of your question, Representative Runbeck, on kind of ridership trends, we do see around the country where system ridership is falling in the pretty much mid-single digits for those systems. Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., even New York City, as well as other systems. Here at Metro Transit, we watch and monitor that very closely, and what we are seeing is about a 4% increase, 17 over 16 on the rail. That's those ridership records that I mentioned. On the bus, we have seen a slight downtick for 17 over 16. That's about a 2.5% reduction. All in, bus and rail, our overall ridership was down very minimally at about 0.5%. Much better performance than what we're seeing with many of our peer systems.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members here from the Met Council. Last year, we've asked on multiple occasions to break down what the operating costs were and the cost to build the line both with federal and state dollars. And we kind of wanted a breakdown of what the subsidy per passenger per mile was on the different modes. I haven't seen that yet. Do you know what the cost per the subsidy per mile is on those?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have all those data points with me today, but certainly we'll make note of that, and I'm sure in future hearings we can speak more specifically about those operating costs, subsidies per mile, per passenger. We track all that. I did not come prepared to speak to that that detailed today on the operating side.
A follow-up, Representative Cosby?
I'm just disappointed that we didn't have that information when it was requested last year multiple times, and here again we are struggling to get information from the Met Council.
We'll make sure we get it, Representative Kosnick. Representative Drozdowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Furman, so I was listening to the response to your question to Representative Runbeck, and it sounds like the ridership is decreasing. Obviously, the infrastructure that state government, the Met Council, has been building has been getting bigger and bigger and bigger every year. So we have a bigger system but less riders. Can you tell us why?
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I will just reemphasize on the rail side, as we do expand the rail infrastructure, the ridership continues to expand. On the bus side, we have really not made significant investments in the bus side. We have about 770 buses that pull out every weekday morning and afternoon, and that's been pretty constant now for about the last 10 years. So we have not made those investments to be able to expand bus service in the region in the recent past.
Follow-up, Representative Drozdowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Furman, where those people who were riding before, where are they going? Is Uber filling that in? Are they getting their wallets out and taking care of business on their own, or what's going on?
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we, again, monitor that ridership very closely and try to get inside the numbers to try to help us answer that question that you posed. And our primary cause for ridership decline here in the last year was due to our Nicollet Mall bus rerouting. Nicollet Mall, as we all know, is the employment spine through the heart of downtown Minneapolis, and we have about a half dozen bus routes that do service that. Due to the city of Minneapolis's redesign and reconstruction of Nicollet Mall, it was closed all of 16 and much of 17, and so that did cause about 600,000 bus passengers to go to alternate routes, alternate modes, I should say, rather than take the bus as it was rerouted farther from their offices. The other thing that we believe is a contributor to that bus ridership slight decline is the gas prices have been at a low ebb in the mid-$2 versus 2009 when there were $4 per gallon prices. So that, we believe, also is a contributor where some people shift from the bus over to their car.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Furman, those 6,000 rides or riders, they were able to, without the taxpayer-subsidized transportation, they found their way to work on their own?
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, 600,000 on an annual basis, we believe, diverted from the bus due to that Nicollet Mall reroute. And so in the interim, when those buses were not able to operate on Nicollet Mall, they found alternate modes. Some may have shifted to the train. Some may have shifted to carpooling or other ways to get to and from their office.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems that when we find that a segment of the tax-subsidized and taxpayer-built system is gone, people do find their way to work. So I find that very interesting. Mr. Furman, it'd be great if the agency would actually ask those people where they went. It'd be interesting to know how they did it on their own without government. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bernardi.
Okay, I took the bait. I just
don't have to.
Yeah, I don't have to, but I'm going to. I just wanted to know what Mr. Chair, Representative Drozdowski, what kind of other modes of transportation do we have that aren't government supported that someone might be able to use?
Are you asking a question of Representative Drozdowski or Mr. Furman?
I would ask Representative Drozdowski, please.
Representative, do you care to respond to that?
I will, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Bernardi, when people drive their own cars, the government's not paying for the carriage in which they ride. They're paying for the roadway. When we have trains, they're paying for the roadway and the carriage in which they ride.
Would you want to respond, Representative Bernardi? I'll give you one more shot at it. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I don't need to ask another question because they are using government-supported facilities to get to work.
Thank you. I believe we're ready to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Focus on the Southwest LRT, also known as the Green Line Extension. And so the scope of that project is departing from the existing Target Field Station on the edge of downtown Minneapolis, where the green and blue lines currently terminate, to the south and west, 14 and a half miles, 15 new stations, forecasted 34,000 passengers per weekday. That compares to our existing blue line of about 32,000 and existing green line daily ridership of slightly more than 40,000. And we'll provide a 26-mile continuous one-seat ride from essentially Eden Prairie Town Center area at Southwest Station all the way through the suburb, southwestern suburbs of Eden Prairie, Minnetonka, Hopkins, St. Louis Park, into Minneapolis, and then on to St. Paul's Union Station over in downtown St. Paul. Overall project schedule here, let me explain what you're looking at here. I mentioned a few minutes ago those specific defined phases that FTA has for these big projects. Project development we completed in 2016. Engineering phase, we're coming upon completion of that here in the near couple months. The record of decision was granted by FTA in July of 2016. That's their federal environmental approval, essentially. And then as we come into 2018, there will be an amended record of decision, and that will capture our current supplemental environmental assessment, which I'll speak to further in a forthcoming slide, related to our shared corridor between LRT and BNSF freight rail just west of downtown. Then we will enter the construction phase. That will require here later this year, late summer and this fall, a letter of no prejudice. And let me explain what that term of art is. That is a request that we will make of the Federal Transit Administration as well as the Hennepin County funding partner, where we can start construction, expend county funds for that purpose, and then it will be eligible for the federal funding match upon execution of the full funding grant agreement, which you see there, currently forecasted for first part of 2019. Then a lot of other technical detail in the bottom half of the chart that I'll respond to questions. I won't take the committee's time to get into that level of detail. And we currently forecast a revenue operation start date in 2023. On the environmental piece, let me give you a little bit of highlights on that. When we negotiate with the Burlington Northern Santa Fe on how we were going to operate in that shared corridor for 1.4 miles. Out of that came what Representative Hornstein already mentioned, a shift of the North Star midday tail track. It also called for a wall, a barrier wall between the single freight rail track and the future two light rail tracks over that 1.4 mile segment. FTA deemed that to have a potential impact on that segment, really the eastern segment of this corridor. So they requested that we assemble a supplemental environmental assessment. So we spent the last couple months doing that. And, in fact, FTA then published that last Friday for a 45-day public comment period. So we will have that open comment, as well as we're going to be sponsoring a community town hall, and that's coming up in 3 weeks on March 22nd. We're going to do that down at the Dunwoody facility there, just off of the corridor. Give you some visuals, just so those of you who may not be so familiar with this corridor. Essentially, it's the I-394 corridor that comes west out of downtown Minneapolis, and so here you can see kind of the current status with the 394 bridge as it comes in from Penn Avenue eastbound into downtown Minneapolis. With the trail here, you can see a current trail user on the right side of the slide. And then with the proposed wall, you can see here a graphic image that we've developed with the future LRT train now operating with the wall behind it, so to provide that barrier protection between light rail and freight rail. Trail continues in the corridor, but is not directly impacted or impeded by the light rail or the wall that would be constructed. We've had a number of community engagements. We did a couple pop-up opportunities along the trail during the fall and invited community folks as well as trail users to give us some feedback on what their vision of the design of this future and proposed wall would look like. And we two primary things that we heard from the community. One is they wanted it to kind of blend into the natural environment as much as it could. So out of that came the idea of putting some ivy on this wall, as well as they wanted to give the actual wall structure a little bit of definition. And so you see some precast form there in the top right, and then identifying the Bassett Creek Valley Station, which is right in the middle of this corridor shared by BNSF and by Southwest LRT. Major project milestones coming up here. I thought I'd highlight a couple of these for the next 6 months. As I said a moment ago, we did publish the supplemental last Friday, and earlier this week we published the Quality Management Services Request for Proposal. And what this is a Met Council effort to bring those quality management oversight and responsibilities within our purview, directly underneath Met Council and my project management team's oversight and direction. So we issued that RFP this week, and those proposals will be due upcoming in April. In March, now that March is upon us, it's the critical time for the Congress to finish their 2018 federal appropriations for these projects, as well as finish up with our freight rail discussions with Burlington Northern, with Canadian Pacific, and with Twin City and Western in this corridor. And that will result in an administrative filing at the Surface Transportation Board to memorialize those actions. Then just finishing up on upcoming activities in May, we hope to finalize the environmental review. That will be a FTA approval and then a Met Council declaration that's all in order based on the input and public comment that we do receive in the next month and a half. We're slated to open up the big civil construction bid in early May, and then those letters of no prejudice requests that I mentioned previously. Then a couple months hence, FTA and Hennepin County will need to act on approving those letters of no prejudice, and that will set the stage for the Met Council to award the civil construction bid to the parent low bid, and then to make that final application to FTA for the federal funding grant.
Thank you, Mr. Furman. I have some questions first from Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Furman. So this whole question of freight rail and light rail co-location has been of great concern to me and many people that I represent. And so, you know, we have a real interest in this negotiation that's taking place with the freight rail companies. Is it true that these negotiations are ongoing and have not concluded yet?
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, yes, it is true. They continue to be active, and we're working hard to close that out here in the coming weeks.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Horns,
a couple more.
I'm just watching the musical chairs going on over here on our side of the. You know, in case you didn't know it, the basement hearing room is my least favorite hearing room, and now I know I have another reason why, because it's not big enough.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
And
your
the
line
quality
of
the chairs is an issue too.
It's somewhat suspect, isn't it?
Yes. Just a couple of them. A couple more questions. So, you know, and I just wanted the committee to know this supplemental assessment only happened because people in our in the area that I represent had organized, and the FTA had actually demanded this. The Met Council didn't initially want to do this, and so I appreciate that this is completed, and I hope we'll have a good turnout at the hearings. But beyond that, why? So there's a wall in the BNSF area. Why isn't there a wall in the CP and TC&W shared corridor?
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, the answer to that is because of the very different characters of these two corridors, where LRT will share these corridors with freight rail operations. The BNSF corridor, the 1.4 miles, that is a much higher utilization freight rail corridor that sees anywhere from 40 to 50 trains per day on average, as well as the speeds in that corridor are typically about 40 miles per hour of those freight rail trains. Contrast that with the CP and TCW corridor there through the Kenilworth part of the project. There again, it's a single track, as with BNSF, but it's only about one-tenth the number of trains that pass through there, typically four or five a day. And those speeds, they can go as much as 20 miles an hour. Practically speaking, those trains typically operate less than that, closer to 10 miles an hour as they come through the Kenilworth corridor.
Representative Hornstein.
Well, it's a longer discussion, but I think there's still lots of risks with the TC&W alignment as well. But my last question, Mr. Chair, on this is that is there an how will you be transferring the trackage rights from CP to Hennepin County and the Met Council? And what is the interaction with the Surface Transportation Board? I know that there's so many entities involved in this. You know, it's quite confusing. And so how will that process take place?
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, I hear two questions there. Number one is the trackage rights. And so that is an active part of our negotiation, is to finalize how that's going to look and essentially who will be the ultimate landlord for this corridor through Kenilworth, and then the freight railroads that will need to basically be the tenant. And so when we finalize those two questions, that will dictate what those trackage right agreements look like. The second half of your question I heard was Surface Transportation Board, and they have some jurisdiction here because of the freight rail operations through the corridor, and that will be their action is an administrative action that will respond to the common carrier question. As per federal law, the STB predecessor, the ICC, and now the Surface Transportation Board has jurisdiction to make sure that there's a free flow of freight through the national freight rail system. And so we will need to go to them through an administrative action to finalize who the common carrier and who has that responsibility for the Kenilworth segment of the project.
One last one, Mr.
Very quickly,
quick comment, Mr. Chair. So I just want the committee to know that, you know, what you're seeing here is a tangled web of jurisdictions, of transferring of rights. You know, all of this has significant consequence for safety. And it's being done in a manner that's not particularly transparent. You know, we found out about this wall really as a result of some discussion of, you know, in this larger negotiation that Mr. Furman is talking about. And so I hope that we will be able to get information about all of this stuff in a timely way so that the public and elected officials can digest it, because it has, you know, tremendous consequence in terms of safety, you know, this co-location. And I was disappointed that the legislature absolved the freight rail companies of liability in a light rail corridor. And thank you, Representative Runvick, for your, you know, support on that. But I hope that, you know, as these negotiations proceed, there's a lot more sunshine, as it were, because you're seeing these this tangled set of jurisdictional relationships and transfers. But at the end of the day, there's some real important discussions that need to take place.
Representative Runbeck, or Draskowski, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Furman, Mr. Shetland, can you remind us this project, this Southwest Light Rail project, what is the overall projected cost again, and can you remind us what the breakout is of local funding to state money to federal spending on this, and what you're expecting from the federal government? And then I'm curious, how much have you spent so far of local and state money? And then how much are you expecting to get from the federal government? And then what happens if the federal money doesn't show up? What's your plan?
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, this project is budgeted at $1.858 billion. And the funding model that we're using, similar to past projects for Blue Line and Green Line, is 50-50 share. Specifically, $929 million of local funding, and that matches dollar for dollar $929 million of federal funding. The primary composition of that local funding mix is the County's Transit Improvement Board, now no longer in existence. They provided about $250 million of their funding over time. And then Hennepin County is stepping into those CTIP shoes, as well as the Hennepin County Regional Railroad Authority, under their authority, is also providing funding that primarily makes up that $929 million worth of local. To the last component of your question about federal funding, we are still very optimistic, and we believe, based on past history and even my three decades of history on this program dating back to the President Reagan era in 1980s, that at the end of the day, Congress is the responsible entity for appropriations, and just as they did in the 1980s when I was working on the metro system in D.C., they provided funding for that metro build-out. And we believe, as evidence with the new Congress and the new President's action of May of 2017, less than a year ago when they approved the $2.5 billion for this program, that those appropriation dollars will again come to be in the 2018 and 19 appropriation years.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Furman, I heard the word hoping. What happens? I mean, I'm reading things a little differently in terms of Congress and the disposition of the President on this project. What is the agency's plan if it doesn't come forward? And coupled with that, how much money have you spent so far?
Mr. Furman.
I can only, Mr. Chair and Representative, I can only recount what my experience has been for over three decades. And so that history, I think, has some value, but it's not always the ultimate predictor of tomorrow or next year. But we believe and we are confident at Met Council, based on that history, that there will continue to be a federal funding participation in this New START program going forward. In terms of how many local dollars have been expended thus far on the project, that answer is $240 million.
50%? So, follow up, Representative Draskowski.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm hearing that the agency has no plan if the federal money doesn't show up. Mr. Furman, is that correct?
Mr. Furman.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Could you repeat the question?
What I'm hearing is that the agency does not have a plan to fund and finish this project up if the federal money doesn't show up. Is that correct?
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, I can speak to that. In the legislation that was passed last year as part of the transportation finance funding bill, the state is not allowed to move forward with paying any of the capital or operating of this line. So if in the event that the federal government didn't allow those funds to be appropriated to this project, it would potentially not allow the council to do that as well, because we've come forward to the legislature to seek funding for that. However, I think that the decision would come down to Hennepin County at that point, since they are the financier of this line locally at this point, to determine whether or not they would want to move forward with that project or not as a county.
So,
final question, Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Shetton, and that was helpful. We're going forward with a project but not having a plan in place if the money that hasn't been committed yet doesn't show up. I don't know if that's normal planning and operating of an agency like yours, but when we're talking about a $1.5 billion project, I think taxpayers of Minnesota would kind of wonder about what's going on. But really no need to respond, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
One of the things that we should, and I'm going to ask Mr. Furman to speak to this, but that gets back to one of the things that we mentioned earlier about the letters of no prejudice that are allowed by our federal partners to allow us to go ahead and spend some of those local dollars toward the project. And so the FTA would be aware that we are doing that. We were in a similar situation. I know Representative Draskowski, you were here as well, when we were going through the process of building which is now the Green Line Central Corridor project, and we did the same thing. So this is no different than where we were back in 2008, 2009, 2010 on that project.
And Mr. Chair, I would just add to what Mr. Shetland said is that the FTA, the feds, always look to the locals and the full local funding commitment before they make their federal match commitment. And so back in 2016, we did secure that full $929 million commitment from CTIB, Hennepin County, and the Hennepin Rail Authority.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. it struck me when you said, Mr. Furman, that you've been working on this for three decades. And it does seem like transportation and our views on transit and the world has changed a bit. Unfortunately, we're still, I think, working on an obsolete model, which is a train on fixed rail. I keep hearing the number $1.986 billion. Does that number, there have been added costs. There's been a wall. There's been a $300 million liability policy for BNSF. There's a new EIS. There's all the contractors that are going to have to go back and rebid. New costs. Are those being reflected in anything that we can learn about? Can we hear the new costs, please?
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, much of the environmental costs, those have already been anticipated in the project budget, and so we're able to do that with existing staff, essentially. In terms of the new proposed wall, we've estimated that as about a $30 million cost that had not previously been assumed in the $1.858 billion cost. And so we do have a contingency that is a requirement for these federal projects so that when new costs should arise, which the wall is a good example of that, we can look to that contingency fund and tap that to pay for those additional incremental costs.
Right, follow-up, Representative Runbeck.
Well, I do. So there have been a number of snags in the schedule over the last few months that are putting, more delays. So here's a year we're looking at almost when, no construction is happening, and it's basically in a standstill. Are you continuing to spend money, and how much money will be spent while we're just waiting?
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we continue to finalize our engineering, and so we have the civil bid on the street, as I mentioned. We have two other significant construction packages, as we call them. One is for construction of our operation and maintenance facility. That engineering is ongoing, and we hope to hit the streets with that bid package in early 2019, in about 10 months. And we also have our systems package, and what that is for all the electrification, signals, communication, and that package is being finalized, and that'll hit the bidding community in October of this year. So, yes, we continue to do that final engineering and continue to spend money for that purpose to prepare those bids to send them to the construction bidding community.
Okay. I mean, it just is troubling that we have sunk costs, essentially, I think, are driving this project. You know, at this point, would they say no, even though they thought it was not a strong project? Because everyone is going to say, gosh, we've spent $300 million already. We've got to keep going. But, frankly, that's a very poor logic. So, but I understand. It's very troubling. Thank you.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is in relation to what Representative Draskowski was referencing, but also the grid, the slide, a few slides back. Mm-hmm. And on this grid, I can see here, and you've also mentioned it, that you're expecting the federal funding in 2019. And so it's my understanding that Minnesota currently has four transit-related projects that are seeking federal funding. One of them is Southwest Light Rail. And recently here, just earlier this month, as a matter of fact, I'm looking at an article where the Federal Transit Administration released their annual report, and one of the lines in there, and this is quoting now, the FTA is limiting funding to projects with existing full funding grant agreements. For the remaining projects of the CIG program, FTA is not requesting or recommending funding. Future investments in new transit projects would be funded by localities that use and benefit from these localized projects. So, in other words, local funding is what they're saying here. And then one more quote from the report. And by the way, this report is the 2019 report. Yeah. And it lines up then with the 2019 expectation of federal dollars. Again, a quote, the administration has developed a comprehensive infrastructure proposal that accelerates projects, spurs private sector innovation, and improves how the federal government delivers infrastructure projects. Transit projects will be eligible to compete for federal financial support in this proposal. However, none of the projects listed in tables 2A, 2B, or 2C are recommended for funding from the CIG program. And then it's my understanding that the four projects that Minnesota has are all listed in those three tables. So how does the grid here that it has federal funding expected in 2019 line up with the FTA's report?
Mr. Furman.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, Representative, really going back to my national map of the CIG peer projects, you see the three there in the Twin Cities. The fourth that you referred to correctly is the Orange Line BRT. That's a small start, smaller scale project that I didn't put on the map because there's 43 other small starts projects. So just to keep it a little bit more comprehensible. So to your question about funding is the core of your question, the administration is required by law to make an annual report called the New Start or the CIG report. And that's the article that was looking at that report that was issued 3 weeks ago by the administration. So that is an administration proposal, just as they had proposed a year ago. And the outcome of that was the Congress appropriating that $2.5 billion. And so the Congress, as I've already reported, is carefully and working hard to complete their 2018 appropriations. By federal law, the FAST Act that was approved and executed back in 2016, that federal authorization provides for up to $2.3 billion of federal money for this CIG program. And so that's the first step. Second step, obviously, is the appropriations committees then need to act, and that's what's in progress right now at the federal level. We believe, as I've already stated and testified, that at the end of the day, when the appropriators finish their business, we believe that there will be dollars for these four projects as we move forward. I should also mention that when that report came out a couple weeks ago, it rated, as a federal requirement, it rates these projects as to the benefits. And so it's a high, medium, medium-low, or low is the five-point rating system. Federal law requires that a project be rated medium or higher to then earn federal funding. Both the Southwest LRT and Botno LRT projects have been rated medium-high, and that was ratified again with the report 3 weeks ago.
Very quickly, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the indulgence. So when you reference appropriation, I presume you mean Congress. Mm-hmm. And so the administration made a proposal, which is what you're saying this report is. Mm-hmm. Well, even if Congress does make an appropriation to this fund, it's still going to be the administration that makes the approval for any applications that come in. And it appears, based on the evidence that we're seeing, that the administration is not going to look favorably upon projects such as these. So I echo the remarks of Representative Draskowski and Representative Lynn Rumbeck that planning projects, billions of dollars on hope, isn't wise. And it's I think we could do a better job and potentially think of some contingencies if they're not funded. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more follow-up question on the wall, if I could. This need to do this, do we see, was this necessary anywhere else in the country that you know of? Do we have any model for how this actually works? Have we run into this in any other state that you know of?
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, we asked ourselves that same question when we were having those BNSF discussions. And yes is the answer. One of the recent Denver projects, actually the project that connects Denver International to their Union Station transit hub downtown, did require a wall. It's a Union Pacific corridor, not a BNSF corridor, but it's a shared freight rail, light rail corridor. And that wall is in place, and those light rail trains are operating today.
So that's why our photos look like the wide open spaces. Are they taken from there?
Mr. Chair, and Representative, the current status is a picture that is not a artist rendering here. And then the next picture, the graphic people drop in the light rail train and the...
And they got me biking there, too.
It does look like you.
Trying to catch the train.
I like your hat.
Representative Hornstein, I need to remind you that no one should be funnier than the chair.
Well, it's the second time in a week he said that to me. Sorry, Mr. Chair. Sorry.
I will keep reminding you. Don't worry. A follow-up, Representative Hausman, are you? Okay. Gentlemen, move along. We have a short session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm ready to move to the Blue Line extension. And that project is, again, a new start. Eligible projects, again, rated medium-high, as I just said. 11 new stations over 13.5 miles extending from Target Field through North Minneapolis to Golden Valley, Robbinsdale, Crystal, up to Brooklyn Park with five stations in Brooklyn Park, which will be very well served by the Blue Line extension. And again, a person can get on the train at the Oak Grove station, which is at the location of the Target North campus, and ride that train into downtown to the International Airport or to the Mall of America as a one-seat ride. Overall timeline on this project, we have finished the first phase project development about a year and a half ago. That included environmental approvals by the FTA and municipal consent approvals as required by state law here in Minnesota by all five municipalities and Hennepin County. We're in the throes of engineering. We're working on completing the 90% level design detail right now. Again, we'll have three packages similar to the similar to Southwest, so construction package, maintenance facility package, which will be in Brooklyn Park, as well as a systems communication signals package. Right now, we are in the process of working with BNSF because of this 13-mile corridor. We share not quite 8 miles of corridor with BNSF. They have a single track in that corridor today, very lightly used. That track sees maybe 4 to 5 trains a week over the course of a given week. And then we would add our two light rail tracks. So we are in the process of engaging BNSF to present to them our detailed designs on how that shared corridor would look, knowing the importance to BNSF on safety for their trains as well as our trains. So until we can get full engagement from BNSF with them, we're not able to put specificity on the calendar for full funding grant and our construction schedule right now. So that's why you see the TBDs there on this chart. A graphic for you to take a preview of what that shared corridor would look like. We're right here there in Golden Valley Road Station, which is kind of on the northeast corner of Theodore Worth Regional Park at Golden Valley Road and Theodore Worth Parkway. So you can see the single track of BNSF that would remain, and then we would design and construct LRT on the eastern half of that corridor. You can see the graphic here with a southbound blue line train on its way to downtown Minneapolis. And here it gives you a cross-section look as to the shared corridor. So the two new light rail tracks are new, and then the freight rail single track would remain as we see it today. I would also add it's important to note that in our design, as we've advanced the design to 90%, we already have designed a shared corridor protection wall for 32% of the shared corridor with BNSF. We have a ditch that would provide separation of 35% of the corridor. We'd have a retained earth embankment for 10% of the corridor, and then the last 23% of the corridor is where we're grade separated or we're at grade intersections where you can't put any sort of protection there where you've got crossing traffic across the light rail and the freight rail. So we've already very much in the front of our minds safety conscious on how we design this, and those are the designs that we want to sit down and present to the BNSF folks, and so we're working to get that set here coming up soon. So that concludes our overview for Green Line Extension, Blue Line Extension. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to respond to any further questions.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the question I have that's been brought up to me at my recent town meeting, that what happens with Botno if Southwest has more problems? Are these two separate projects going forward, or if Southwest gets pushed back, does that push Botno back farther?
Mr. Furman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, they are two separate projects, rated separately, managed separately, all under the purview of Metropolitan Council. So the two projects are not linked at the hip, if you will. So if there's a scenario where Southwest experiences, you know, something that comes out of the environmental review that we started last Friday that we did not know of or did not expect that causes some sort of Southwest delay, that does not interfere or cause domino delays for the Botno project.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please move along.
Mr. Chair, I'm done with the presentation here, so any final questions for the light rail piece?
Quickly, Representative Hausman, we're running out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just maybe a closing comment, which you may or may not want to respond to, because it seems to me we always have to acknowledge the context in which we're planning this. And that is a million more people. I go back to the time when Carol Molnau was chairing this committee. And at the time, we knew we had to prepare for another million people moving to this area. This is the economic engine of the state. The bulk of the taxes are generated here, and then they go everywhere to do good stuff. And so we have to keep this economic engine going, even though a million more people come here. And we can't wait till they're here. So at the time, MnDOT did a study. And how much would it cost to do one more lane on the 494-694 circle? That's back when Carol Molnau was here. I don't know what the inflation would do to it now. But then the number was one more lane, $15 billion. Because, of course, we have a lot of big bridges, if you think of that 494-694 corridor. That reality is what drives this. That reality is what drives this. And so there is a connection between the various tools we have at our disposal.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. We'll move along to the next part of the presentation.
Mr. Chair and members, we were asked by you to come and provide an overview to the committee related to the Southwest LRT construction procurement that we were doing. This issue was raised during the interim. We spoke to it a couple times at the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government, and I've got with me Mary Bogie, who's our Chief Financial Officer at the Council, whose division oversees our procurement division, and she's going to be able to speak to the process, the timeline, and the issues that were raised related to some questions about some conflicts of interest amongst some of the contractors that were seeking to bid on this.
Thank you, Mr. Shetland. We are limited on time, and I appreciate your coming to the committee, but I would really appreciate if you can go through this quickly. If we need to revisit it at a later date, we will.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Again, my name is Mary Bogan, the Chief Financial Officer for the Metropolitan Council, and I do speak very quickly, so I think we can get through this pretty quickly. So I was asked to come and talk about our civil construction bid, and I will say that this is an active solicitation, and so I may not be able to answer questions if we're talking about evaluative data, because that is private, non-public data as we go through this procurement process. That data privacy really helps us keep this a full and open procurement all the way through the entire process. So Mark had stated earlier that this is the largest public works project that we've had in the state, and that adds to the complexity of the solicitation. So on the screen here, I just have our invitation for civil construction bid, and we initially issued that invitation for bids back in February 14th of 2017. We've extended the bid a number of times for a variety of reasons. We opened the bid last August and ended up rejecting those bids. We reissued that bid then in October, and now we are anticipating to open those bids in May of 2018, so coming up here in a few months. Earlier this week, we actually pulled our quality management services out of that construction bid and made that a separate solicitation. That allows us to make that an owner-controlled, owner-managed service. And so that comes out of the construction, and we issued that last week, and that also will be awarded in the May timeframe. So this procurement is a federal procurement, and therefore we need to follow our federal code of regulations. On the screen here, this is the language from the federal code of regulations as it relates to competition. Full and open competition is the guiding principle for federal procurement requirements and practices. In 2015, the federal government really clarified and expanded, in particular on the audit side, the uniform guidance related to full and open competition. This principle has one primary and two secondary purposes. The primary purpose is to get a best quality service for the least cost. Secondary purposes are to guard against favoritism and profiteering at the public's expense and to provide equal opportunities for qualified offerors to participate in public business opportunities. Our procurement process is consistent with the FTA's procurement best practices. Relative to the language here, the FTA best practice manual suggests the recipient can prevent such unfair advantage by placing reasonable restrictions or even prohibition on a contractor's involvement in a subsequent procurement. The council chose long ago to remove any ambiguity regarding an apparent or a real unfair competitive advantage by prohibiting subcontractors from work on both the design as well as the construction for construction contracts. Our procurement policies, practices, and communications support that. So as a result of that, the federal guidance here and their expanded guidance, our state auditors also updated their audit practices around competitive advantage, and in 2016 we have received an oral comment. An oral comment is not a finding, but it's a oral comment about a lack of documentation in our procurement files as it related to enforcing this regulation. Since that, we take those things very seriously. We don't want them to turn into findings in later years, so we added communication both to this invitation for bid advertisement and other documents to make subcontractors and our prime contractor aware of the restriction on subcontractors.
Sorry, I'm jumping really fast.
So our council policies and procedures, our contract that we have, the prime contractor for design, contains language in it that tells the subcontractor that it's passed along to the subcontractor that those subcontractors are agreeing, if they are a part of the design contract, they understand that they're not allowed to be a part of the contractor's team for the construction. So this is our contract language. This language aligns pretty well with what the state and MnDOT does for the language as well, but we've also communicated this language in several different ways. So as I said, it was a part of the invitation for bid and in the advertisement. We also answered questions related to this, both in Addendum 2, we had a question where we restated the federal requirements. In Addendum 6, we had a question where we referred to the specific language in the contract as it related to that restriction. And then, again, as we prepared to rebid, we sent an email to all of the plan holders to clarify that subcontractor restriction and responsiveness. As well, our prime contractor for the design communicated with the subcontractors about this restriction. They sent an email back in March of 2016 highlighting their responsibilities. Again, in May, they were following up with the previous email to highlight their responsibilities, and then just prior to the bid opening, they also sent an email out to the design subcontractors. So we were very clear about this restriction as we move through this procurement process.
Thank you. I don't see any questions. Thank you for your presentation. We'll probably revisit this issue on a future date. Next, we're going to jump towards the end of the agenda here. We have some folks here from the Kenilworth Corridor that would like to submit some testimony. So, Mr. Lilly, Mr. Paddock, and Mr. Chazen, if you're available. I guess it's not all misters, is it? Sorry, Mary, I didn't. I was reading a little too quickly. It's one of those days, Clark. I just can't help it. Welcome to the musical chair committee room.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for asking us to come over. The original invitation, if I remember correctly, was to come over and talk about the status of our lawsuit, Lakes and Parks Alliance versus the Met Council and the FTA. I had hoped to be talking to you in an entirely different perspective than I am today. We lost, as you all know. Judge Thunheim ruled against us 2 days ago. We're considering our options going forward, but I did want to bring to this committee's attention a very important aspect of Judge Thunheim's decision that I think the legislature should be concerned about. Our case, without getting into the weeds, basically said, or our claim said, that the Met Council irretrievably and irreversibly committed to the Kenilworth route before an environmental impact statement was prepared. We have plenty of evidence to show that that was the case. The court, including the agreements between the municipalities along the line, the so-called memorandum of understanding, we said are virtual contracts, they're valid and enforceable. The court disagreed. That's because the Met Council said, oh, those aren't real contracts, those aren't enforceable, we can rip them up anytime we want to. But more important, in order for the judge to find that they weren't enforceable, he turned to state law. And here's what he said about the LRT enabling legislation. He said state law, while well-intentioned, severely restricts the council's ability to move light rail projects forward during the planning and design phases because the state's municipal consent regimen effectively gives veto power to every local government along the route. I think that was the intention of the law. He later says, the state's municipal consent process enables local governments to attempt to hold light rail projects hostage if they disapprove of any part of the project. So that is how it stands in terms of what the judge said and how he's interpreted Minnesota law. It seems to me the legislature did not intend for Minnesota law to be interpreted that way. It seems to me, if you're so inclined, that perhaps that is something that should be addressed going forward. Thank you. I'm happy to answer questions.
I do not have any questions at the moment. Ms. Paddock, did you have any comments?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm Mary Paddock, live at 2782 Dean Parkway in Minneapolis. And I have a question, and it's this. Will the state really allow Southwest LRT to go forward when it is a product of chronic misrepresentation and defiance of both government and the public? Southwest LRT was not supposed to be co-located with freight, but it is. It was not supposed to have a 10-foot wall going through Minneapolis. It will. It was initially going to cost $900 million. Then it was going to cost $1.2 billion. Then it was going to cost $1.5 billion. Now it's at $1.86 something, already double the initial cost. The construction bids will undoubtedly drive it higher. Is there a point at which somebody says, this is too much, this wasn't the deal? The Met Council has displayed two sets of books, one to make it look rich for purposes of funding and one to make it look poor for purposes of funding. Does anybody really know how much Southwest LRT is going to cost, how it's going to be funded, how it's going to be replaced when the cars need replacing? What are the costs going into the future, and who's going to pay for them? Does anybody know what to believe when the Met Council speaks? Then let's look at their defiance. They defied the city of Minneapolis and the park board, bullying them into acquiescence. And now a court order frees them to break even those commitments to those entities and to other municipalities. As you well know, it defied the legislature, promising you that Southwest LRT would not be built without state funding. It broke that promise, and it devised its own independent source of revenue to circumvent the will of this body. The Met Council is like a nation unto itself. It's unelected, reporting to no one except the governor. It has an independent source of income. It defies any and all elected bodies. It does not always tell the exact truth. And it now has a license to break contracts that get in its way. So here's my question as a citizen and a taxpayer. Is the legislature willing and able to assert its power to rein in this juggernaut and stop it from making one of the biggest financial mistakes in Minnesota history?
Representative Kosnick has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the testifier's comments. In regards to the wall, so I recognize you don't want the project, but are you in favor of having that wall for safety, or no, or you'll put up with it because it makes it safer even though you don't want the project in general? If you could just kind of clarify your position on the wall.
Well, here's the deal on the wall. The railroads say they need the wall for safety, and yet, as in answer to Representative Hornstein's questions in the past, there are still areas where the, let me put this a different way, the railroads want it for their own safety, and they put it in a critical area where it would do the most damage to them. There are still citizens who live there, hundreds of them, in little apartment houses jammed right next to those tracks. There's nothing to protect them. You know, so the answer is that it shouldn't be put there because it cannot be properly, people cannot be properly defended. And then the point of our lawsuit was, look at other alternative routes. For example, there are, the population in Uptown has zoomed because of new residences that have put up there. The numbers have changed. There's a sunken channel where it could be put in, where it's safe, would save more people, would go where there's density. You know, it's just in the wrong place. So should there be a wall? I guess it should be, but that doesn't really address the big problems.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a very brief statement from what I've been hearing. Ma'am, first of all, that is excellent testimony, and I really appreciate it. I think you articulated many of the concerns that I have in general with the Met Council and how they've approached this, and I think it's problematic. And, Mr. Chair, I certainly hope that this committee, I am very concerned that the path this is going is we're going to spend too much for it to fail, and at such time that the federal government says we can no longer do, either they're going to go to the federal government and say, you got to give us some money because it's too much to fail at this point, or they're going to come back to the state and say, we have this half-finished project. Remember a couple days ago, we had another half-finished project that needs at least another $43 million, if not probably another $43 million on top of that. This is a trend that we're seeing to where things are just plowed forward into by people that are supposed to be responsible for the taxpayers and they aren't. And I am very concerned, and I hope we can come up with some policy that says, Met Council, you cannot continue to do this until at least, they really should be answering all these questions, but they should at least say we're not going to move forward until we know we have the rest of the funding, because I don't want to see a half-finished project sitting there and all the burden is put on the taxpayers because of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Miller. I did not hear a question in there. I do not see any other questions for the testifiers. Thank you for being with us today. I appreciate the update. Next, we will bring down the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Welcome to the testifiers table. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for OLA's Program Evaluation Division. And I know we're short on time, and so I will do my best to go quickly. I'm going to talk quickly about this report that I think is in your packet. It was the first quarterly transit financial activity review that we conducted. Last session, the legislature directed our office to conduct these financial activity reviews of transit every quarter ongoing. I'm looking at Met Council and CTIB when CTIB was still around. We've issued two of these. We're working on our third right now. The bottom line on these reports is overall we thought the financial condition of the Metropolitan Council was sound and they had adequate, I will note,
our more recent information shows growing surplus or reserve balance, which does cover their variation in cash flow and the variation in expenses. I'll kind of put a bookmark on the fact that those reserve balances do seem to be growing, and that might be something we talk about with future reports. The one area where we had a concern, and the previous testifier kind of alluded to it, is that we noticed that the Met Council reports its financial condition differently to the Federal Transportation Administration than it does to the state legislature and kind of the budget that presents both internally and to you all. If I could direct your attention in these reports to page 15 and 16, I think that will be the easiest. Page 15 is Exhibit 8, and this is the financial condition that it reports to the federal government. It shows actual expenditures for 2016 and then projected expenditures for the next 5 years. If you flip the so that's page 15 to the feds. If you flip the page to page 16, this is how it reports its transportation funding more to the legislature. And what you will notice here is that there are different numbers, frankly. So Exhibit 9, what it presents to the state is that there is a significant deficit. If you look at Exhibit 8, it has a significantly smaller deficit, and then it also shows the reserve balance. So the bottom line number for the feds looks pretty good, and then the bottom line number for the state doesn't look so good. We talked with the council about why there's different reports and different numbers here, and there's a couple of reasons why. They talk a lot about the timeline. There's different assumptions that they use based on timelines, and so that leads to different numbers. But they also include different expenditures in the two different reports. In the numbers to the state, they include more of the expenses associated with the suburban transit plan, for example. They make different assumptions about how much Metro Mobility is going to cost in the future. And then again, to the feds, they report their full reserve balance, while to the state they don't. And so our recommendation, we're not saying that one set of books is wrong and one set of books is right, but what we're saying is that there are clearly different assumptions being used when they put together these numbers, and we think there needs to be more transparency about what are you assuming, what are they assuming when they put these numbers together, and what is the impact of those assumptions on the bottom line. We think that's information that the legislature should have as you're having these discussions going forward. So we've recommended to the Met Council to provide a really clear crosswalk about what assumptions are included in each report, what's the impact of those assumptions, and then let you be the judge for what you think of those assumptions. That's it in a nutshell, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to take questions, but I can also be done.
Thanks. Wow, that was speedy.
Really fast.
So I have a question. Which side of this page does the governor look at?
Mr. Chair, you'll have to ask him or the Met Council.
That was somewhat rhetorical. Yeah. Representative Runbeck has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned this line, suburban transit, and maybe you could explain more about that, because it appears in the numbers that are presented to the state, but not in the numbers presented to the feds. And what do you think they're actually doing here? I mean, that's a lot of money.
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck. So my understanding is that to the federal government, they present the Met Council's direct responsibility related to suburban transit. And to the state, they are presenting all of the costs and liabilities associated with suburban transit. I'm getting nods from the Met Council. Now, why they do that, I don't know. I don't know why they include the whole bucket in the state numbers and only their direct responsibility in the federal numbers. My guess is they're reporting to the feds exactly what the feds require. And then they're presenting a whole picture to the state on that cost line. But you'd have to ask them why they're using those different assumptions in the different reports.
And so, Ms. Randall, Mr. Chair, so these are numbers that actually suburban transit is expensing. They are not being expended by Metro Mobility. Is that correct?
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, that is my understanding. I think for some of the expenses, the money flows through the Met Council and then out to suburban transit. I'm getting nods. And so I think they're reflecting all of that in with the state, and then for the feds, they're just reflecting their slice of it. But again, these different, I mean, these are the types of questions
I think it's great that we're discussing it, and I think this is the type of information that should just be available so that you understand why there's these differences.
Right. And I know that as a member and as a member of this committee and working with our fiscal analysts that, you know, over the last few years it's been very difficult to get many, many real answers from the Met Council. I mean, this is a game that is being played with this legislature. You know, these folks, somebody said, are not trustworthy. And I guess, if anything, we need to be able to show to the federal government that some of the numbers they've presented probably in their supplemental evaluation, you know, what the benefits are going to be and all the ridership, I think that's going to be questionable too. So I think we need those numbers. We need to see how they've done the math on that because, frankly, I don't buy that these are medium-high projects either when it comes to the benefits. It's really, really disturbing, and I know a lot of people share my concern.
Mr. Chair and Representative Rembeck, if I can just respond. I agree. I think you should ask for all the information, and I think you should get it. You know, I think we're starting to shine a spotlight on it, and I think the Met Council has indicated a willingness to provide additional information, and we are encouraging them to do so.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Randall, and it is all about that federal money. So I think if that money hadn't been promised and thrown out there, we would not be seeing proposals for a, you know, $10 billion, $15 billion system. Because certainly we aren't going to be paying for that here out of our own coffers and the local coffers. But this is quite the shell game. Pretty interesting. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I like that I split this. Sorry, Mr. Chair. Apologize for that. But usually it goes the other way around for people a lot of times. So anyway, I apologize for saying that. But anyway. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Rudolph, I just wanted to understand that there are different assumptions that are required. Am I accurate to understand that there's different fiscal year and there's calendar year, there's different assumptions at the state is asking for and that the federal is asking for? And is that accurate? And are you trying to bridge the two reports so it becomes more clear for people to understand it and that there's not necessarily wrongdoing? And that's, I just want to get a clarification about that.
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bernardi, we're not saying that there's wrongdoing. We're definitely saying there's a lack of clarity. My understanding is that the Met Council is responding to federal guidelines in terms of how they're doing their plan to the federal government. The state doesn't establish a set of assumptions that the Met Council must use when reporting to the state. You know, so the council has kind of chosen that set of assumptions. We are suggesting some clarity about, fine, if you need to meet certain requirements for a federal report, then do that, but then explain why those numbers are so different from the numbers that you're reporting to the state. And I think, you know, what really kind of set up the red flag for us, to be frank, is, you know, to the federal government, it looks pretty rosy. And then to the state, they come and say, we have a deficit, we need help. And so it looks like they are changing the message to suit the audience. Now, I think that there are explanations for the differences. And so we're trying to encourage them to provide an explanation for why those differences exist. But on its face, it begs a lot of questions.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I'm hearing this summary of the report and then in relation to Representative Rumbeck's comments, an old adage comes to my head, and I may have referenced it in this committee before, and that is, when you torture the data long enough, it'll confess to anything. And that's exactly what's happening here. It's the intent to create a desired outcome and paint a different picture depending upon the audience that's listening. That is exactly why they're using two sets of books to paint different pictures, and it's very frustrating and very concerning. And I echo Representative Miller's comments that this body, the Metropolitan Council, needs to be reined in. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you. Do you mind waiting, Frank? I'm going to have the Met Council come forward, or do you want to ask
just
your question?
Just one sec. I mean,
I just wanted to make sure the committee saw on 17, and I understand this issue of the federal and state, and I imagine Mr. Shetman will respond to that. But just, you know, the OLA did say that they didn't see significant problems in the historical balance sheets, and the council's maintained adequate reserves to adjust for variation. So I know you didn't mention that. It's in the report, and I hope that that's on the record.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Representative Hornstein, it was the first thing I said.
Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, I think fundamentally we didn't find his problems with the fund balances. It's all in the reporting, but absolutely.
Mr. Shetman is going to explain to us the difference between an ending operating reserve and an operating fund surplus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetman, the Government Affairs Director at the Met Council. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this. I want to assure everyone that we do not look at this as a game. That is not what we do ever, and we do not do that to the committee. We don't do that to our federal partners. We don't do that to our state partners, and we would never do that to you. The takeaway that I want to leave with you is, and I appreciate Ms. Randall saying that, and you, Representative Hornstein, repeating it, is that the auditor did not find any significant issues with their audit. What they found was that there is an issue related to how we present something to our federal partners and how we present something to the state. And those are two very, very different documents that were never meant to reconcile. And they're based off of very different assumptions and requirements. And so when you ask Mr. Chair about where do the reserves and budgets, how do they look different? They look different because of the assumptions. The assumption for our financial capacity plan for the feds is a 10-year look back and a 20-year look forward. And what they look at is what our funding looks like over the previous 10 years, and is it reasonable to look forward the next 20 and think that we're going to have those funds? And the fact is that we came to the legislature last year in previous bienniums with deficits, and we left the session with a budget that either preserved and maintained or gave us a little bit of money. So to be able to look at that over those last 10 years and then look forward over the next 20, that was a reasonable assumption, and that is what we presented to our federal partners. What we present to the legislature is a 4-year look of where we're at with current service, current revenues, and current law. And we provide that as part of the budget system, and that's where we're at. And what happens during that period of time is that there are forecasts that come out and adjust those numbers, and we adjust those right along with the state, how other committees and this committee go ahead and make decisions related to budgets. And so that is just a little bit of an explanation of where they don't necessarily interact. However, I've spent a lot of time with Ms. Randall and her staff at the auditor's office, and we've had some really good conversations related to how things need to be shared with the committee and with the legislature. And yesterday in Representative Anderson's committee in State Government Finance, we discussed this report as well, and the council is happy to have that conversation and be able to show those. In the past, you know, these documents really don't interact anywhere other than when the auditor took a look at them. And so what we were able to do is prepare a document that allowed us to reconcile the differences between those two charts that really aren't meant to interact with each other. But for the sake of the committee, we wanted to do that, and we also made the commitment that moving forward that we'd be able to show that information. Mr. Chair, Senator Osmick has a bill we testified on Tuesday in committee that basically puts forward the one recommendation that the auditor made, and we're happy to work with, we said we were happy to work with Representative Osmick, Senator Osmick on that bill. There isn't a House author for that bill yet, but we'd be happy to work with that member as well. But I want to assure the committee that we do not look at this as a game. We take this extremely serious. We think that the services that we provide and the money we receive from the legislature is very important to us. And if there are any questions related to how we put that together, we're happy to do it. And I think moving forward, based on our work with the auditor, that folks will be able to see that. But that is, I just wanted to be clear again about that comment.
Thank you, Mr. Shetman. Representative Hausman, and then I want to save a little time for Mr. Lee to present his spreadsheet.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to suggest to Ms. Randall that the written words here in the report seem dispassionate and not judgmental, but I had the sense that your spoken words here had an air of judgment about them that's sort of surprising to me from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and I just needed to express that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Houseman, I think you're correct. You are correct. The written words are pretty oddity, right? They are. And as we, as Representative Hornstein pointed out, and Mr. Shetland said, and I said, there weren't significant problems, I think, with the financial condition. I think what you're hearing from me is some frustration because we've been having this conversation for a couple of months. Well, I'll just say, you know, in our job, we do financial audits, we do program evaluations, we do special reviews, we do investigations. And in a lot of those, we are asked to come to judgment. And so while, you know, all of our work is based on facts, there are times when we come to judgments. And so in this case, there's some judgment about frustration that something that we perceive is pretty easy to do. I mean, Mr. Shetland just passed it out. I think that we're going to see a lot of movement going forward. It's a pretty easy thing to do to provide some basic information about the assumptions. And it just, it seemed like it took a lot to get to that point, but we're here now. So I'm hopeful that this is all going to be in the past.
Thank you. I'm going to move on to Mr. Lee and his spreadsheet. You want to do it from right there? All right.
Mr. Chair and members, in your packets there should be a legal-sized landscape spreadsheet that looks like this. It's titled at the top Metropolitan Council Transportation Balance as Forecast.
We don't have it over here.
Oh, being handed out. Sorry.
Okay, it's done.
Mr. Chair and members, while that's being passed out, I'll sort of explain how I came to the spreadsheet. After the presentation by the legislative auditor to the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government, I decided to try to reconcile the numbers that the council had given the auditor and what the council has presented to the legislature in terms of building budget requests. So the spreadsheet is sort of a result of data that the council has sent to me on both revenues and spending. And sort of the critical piece of this is how the council forecasts its revenues and spending going forward. So that's essentially how the council gets at the number of what a operating deficit or surplus will be. I should mention that this spreadsheet is intended only to look at operating. It doesn't look at capital. It doesn't look at construction of new transit lines. It's just about operating. So on the first side of the sheet, the two sides look similar, but just the side that's titled Metropolitan Council Transit Balance as Forecast by the Council Regional Plan. What you're looking at on lines 6 through 15 are the revenues, and then on line 17 is those revenues plus the carry-forward balance. The council maintains a balance for a few different reasons. One is to maintain a certain policy for operating, and that's about a month's worth of reserve operating for the bus system for light rail. And then there's also a balance that's set aside that is, you can see on lines 7 and 8. When the council budgets, it assumes that it's only spending 95% of its allocated motor vehicle sales tax receipts. And that's sort of a hedge that those receipts may come in under, so they budget a smaller amount, and they also keep that in reserves and then budget it into the next year. Then on lines 19 through 26 are the council's operating expenses. And I should note that this, so on, you're looking at actuals between calendar year 2012 and calendar year 2016, and then the projected for 2017, so that year hasn't quite closed out yet, but that's what they think that they spent, and then the budgeted amounts or the forecast amounts going forward. And I've kind of, for the interest of brevity, compressed everything down to a few lines. So under Metro Transit, that's all bus operations, light rail, commuter rail. And then on line 21 is contracted services, and so that's everything else that the council does in terms of transit. So that's metro mobility mostly, but a few other pieces. And then on line 22 is the regional allocation that the council assigns its administrative costs to all the various components of the council. So that includes transit to wastewater to parks. Then I do the calculation of the revenues minus the expense. And so you can see on line 27 the history of sort of modest balances when comparing revenues to spending. And then in the years going forward, you can see the projected deficits. So then the calculation of how does that impact with the total balance is on line 30. And then the operating reserve policy. So that's the policy that the council wants to maintain a certain level of balance to have about a month's worth of operating and to, you know, maintain reserves for any contingencies like increased fuel prices or so on. So kind of the best way to understand this going forward into the projection is if you look on the box in the upper right-hand side, you can see that's the spending. So you can see the solid lines are the actuals or the projected for 2017, and then the dotted lines are where the projected spending is going. Sort of the key assumptions that go into this is that the inflator, so what the council assumes cost will increase year over year, is based off of the budgeted amount for calendar 18. So you can see that there's that little jump. Part of that is because of something that the council mentioned in their response to the OLA on the first bullet point, federal capital maintenance. Federally funded salaries for capital projects are funded out of the operating budget, and so that is part of that increase and part of why that budgeted is a little bit more than the actual. But there's another few pieces in this, and sort of the history going back to comparing their budget to their actuals is that their budgeted tends to be a bit higher than their actuals by about 5 to 6% typically. So with that, you can see the balance in their spending on the next chart below that one. You can see where we're at in calendar 2017. So the top line is their total balance. And then the bottom line is their balance less their reserves. So you can see that by calendar 19, they're about depleted their balance after their reserves. And then by calendar 2020, they are spending more than would be in their balances. On the next, if you flip that spreadsheet over, I did a run. This is not numbers that come from the council. This is just sort of looking at, rather than building the inflator off of the budget, what would happen if the inflator was built off of the projected 2017 level of spending. And that's sort of a different picture. So the key assumptions here is that it's sort of built off of 2017 rather than a budget for 2018. And you can see that then the inflator and which is actually a little bit higher than the council's budget. In the council's budget, the inflator is, for most items, 3.15%. But in this scenario, I use an average of the last, going back to calendar 2012 to 2016, of how has that growth happened year over year. So let's assume that level of growth. And that's sort of where you get. Now, you can see that difference kind of changes the picture in terms of the projection with the balance, where there's still year-over-year deficits in terms of revenue minus spending. So that's what you can see on line 63. But sort of it changes sort of the how fast it takes to get there. So there's a few things that are kind of important to keep in mind is that these two different pictures are sort of one is a little bit more pessimistic and one is a little bit more optimistic. What else? I guess I'd stand for any questions. So
thank you, Mr. Lee. I don't see any, I do see a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lee, could you tell me what interest rates you were using? You referenced a year.
Yeah.
And what was going on in the economy at that time?
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair and members, the inflation rate for the council's forecasted budget, what the council uses when they assume growth in spending, is 3.15%. So that's when they do their forecasted budget, they assume 3.45%. And that's sort of off of the budgeted amount. So the rate of the increase is different between the two because off of the budgeted amount is that lower rate of inflation. But off of just the actual, in my initial run, I used the exact same inflator and said, okay, using this inflator off of an actual, where does that get you? And that would show a completely different picture. That would show something where the council would have operating, if not surpluses, but enough balance to cover deficits for quite a few years into past 2021. So in meeting with the council, there was some discussion that that might be a bit optimistic. So in the second scenario, I did a more aggressive aggressive inflation rate using the average of the last from calendar 2012 to calendar 2016, which has a higher rate. And if you look down on line 72, that assumes a growth rate of 5.68% for Metro Transit and 6.12% for contracted services. And I should maybe also clarify, that doesn't have anything to do with interest rates in terms of banks lending money. Sort of the closest approximation would be the interest rate for construction or delivering services.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. The next meeting of this committee will be next Tuesday in this room.